Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of the Leaders in Value Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, and great pleasure to have with us today Dave Wheeler, who is the Chief Operating Officer of New Balance Athletics. Many of you know they are a great sports brand and apparel. I know them specifically because I have some vested interests, so they sponsor many great athletes. In particular, I am a tennis former player myself, not very good one, albeit, but okay, I did play some tennis, and I do follow tennis, and there's Coco Gauff, yeah, that is a very good tennis player, but more importantly for me as a Romanian, they also sponsor Sorana Cârstea, who is a great tennis player from Romania, so that's why I have a vested interest in New Balance and think they're awesome, on top of a great product. And Dave is running the whole end-to-end operations. He also, very interestingly, has product development under his scope. And ever since he joined the company, they've had a tremendous growth. He's been there from 2017, and he'll tell us more about that in the podcast. So Dave, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to join and share a few thoughts here with you over the next little bit.
And I want to start, because you've had a interesting, to say the least, I think it's an understatement, your career has been quite unique as far as I have seen you, right? So you've started in the U.S. Department of Defense. You literally worked, I don't know if you also flew, but you worked with fighter jets and the state-of-the-art technology. Then you were at Union Pacific, yeah, which is obviously transport logistics type of a business. Then you went at Cintas Corporation for a long time, where you were doing global supply chain and fleet management. And now since 2017 with New Balance and being part of their board on as a chief operations officer. So love to ask you, what were some of the inflection points in this career that has spanned quite a bit of different, you know, well, industries, from defense to transportation to, you know, Cintas was, you know, a combination of services as well as a product to now apparel?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll just start out by saying I'm really blessed to have such a wonderful, diverse career opportunity. And I think if I mentioned Steve Jobs, he did a great job at a commencement speech. That was actually a graduation speech at Stanford. And if you haven't seen that video, I'd recommend it. You know, he said, you can't connect the dots looking forward, but you certainly can looking back. And for me, I never would have imagined a career this diverse, but as I look at those various dots that you just mentioned, they really have helped me broaden my horizons and be a better leader, better decision maker. And as you mentioned, straight out of the gate as an electrical engineer, I had the opportunity to work for the Department of Defense here in the U.S. And it was kind of in the peak of the Cold War with Russia, and we had to make the best fighter jet possible. And so I had the opportunity to get out and actually interview fighter jet pilots to understand what they wanted in integrated navigation suite within the cockpit, and then really listen to, if they could have anything in the world, what would it be? And so when you talk about a blank slate, and just, it's an engineer's dream, we'll say that. And really cool to be able to sit down with those pilots and listen to real consumer feedback, and then design from scratch what that future fighter jet was going to look like. And so for me, that was an eye-opener. And I think, so that whole project was just a tremendous, I guess, opportunity for me to make an impact for the country. And that fighter jet is still one of the best air-to-air fighters in the world. It's called the F-22 Raptor. So that was terrific. I think in that particular project, you know, one thing that really stuck out at me, and I'll mention two things within the F-22 project. First off, we really needed to make sure we had a crypto key that would plug into each aircraft and decipher the code to be able to communicate amongst the aircraft and also, you know, air to ground. And Motorola was the contractor for it. This is back in 1986. And when I walked into the factory and I looked at how they were making the prototypes, everything had a statistical process control chart associated with it. Everything was connected. They weren't looking at averages on each individual process, but they were actually plotting it out, and they were looking at variation. And so that was actually the kind of the beginning of Six Sigma and how to drive out variation from production. And so as a young guy coming out of college and just seeing Six Sigma in action with the structured problem solving of DMAIC, it made a huge impact on my career, really, to be able to not only learn it, but then apply that in every single job I had going forward. So that first stop was significant for me as a really just a young engineer, just out there trying to make a difference in the world. And so many good opportunities came from that.
Well, that's one heck of a story. And ultimately, if we think pragmatically, fighter jets are, I mean, between fighter jets and probably NASA rockets, I don't think you can get much more technically advanced pieces of manufacturing equipment, because they are highly, highly advanced. So yeah, what a story there. I also want to ask you, because you've really, so you know, over the course of a 40-year almost career, sorry to make you look old for a second, but
that's true. It's
you've
true.
Really only been with four companies. Well, with four, yeah, companies you can call the U.S. Department of Defense is ultimately what an organization. So four organizations, not at all common, as you know, in today's world. We probably, well, I've myself probably changed four companies in the first 5 years of my of my so a career. And I'm curious a little bit also on this topic, because nowadays, of course, it's quite different. And you mentioned connecting the dots looking backwards. So I'm pretty sure that it wasn't all planned, or it wasn't. But, you know, what kind of also led you when you decided to make the shifts, given that you've been quite, you know, quite successful in every job and you've gotten promoted several times? Why did you make the shifts, which were four in total, three actually in total in your career? What drove that switch?
Yeah, I think each switch was slightly different. I'll just kind of mention each one briefly. I think Department of Defense, I was in there for about 8 years. And 1993, and actually in 1990 to 1993, was really kind of the end of the Cold War. If you remember, the Berlin Wall fell. And as I, yeah. And I, in that period of time, I also went through my MBA program at night and on the weekends. So that's a whole other conversation about a lot of hard work and a lot of long days to get through that. But really, helped me. That MBA helped me broaden out beyond just an engineer. Engineering school teaches you how to go deep in engineering, but it really doesn't teach you about business at all. And so between the MBA and my engineering degree helped me become a broader leader, I would say. And so with the end of the Cold War, I really started to think, is the defense industry where I want to be long term and retire? Or should I get out into the commercial world and see what that looks like? And that was the particular reason for jumping from the DOD over to Union Pacific. Union Pacific actually came calling, and I said I would at least talk to them. They flew me out to Omaha, Nebraska. I grew up in Boston. I didn't even know where Omaha, Nebraska was, to be honest with you. I had to look it up on a map. And as I went out and interviewed, I actually turned out that it was just a fantastic place to not only live, but raise a family. And so we had our first daughter when I was out there. And Union Pacific was a terrific company, obviously the biggest railroad in the world, gave me huge opportunities in the M&A world. So I ran a lot of M&A during the 90s. We really bought up a lot of other railroads and continue to be the largest railroad in the country, only rivaled by the Russian railroad as far as size, and just some other leadership opportunities. I started to think I would actually retire from Union Pacific, and just the opportunities seem endless. But I had a call from a CEO at Cintas, a company that presented at one of my MBA classes. The CEO came in when I was actually in the DOD. And he and I got to know each other. We stayed in touch while I was at Union Pacific for that period of time. And he called and said, look, you know, the last time you knew us, really, we were $100 million company. We're now $1 billion company through acquisition. We kind of act like many different companies, different systems, different processes. And would you at least come talk to us and see if you're interested in joining our company? So I did go out and talk to them back in Cincinnati. And They made an offer I couldn't refuse. And so I left Union Pacific and made that leap. It was a terrific opportunity for me to come in and kind of the first mission was to fix what was not known as the supply chain, but it was a whole bunch of disconnected parts of the supply chain, not integrated at all. Basically, production planning was causing some chaos in the warehouse with too much inventory. Things were just not at all connected. And so I came in with my Six Sigma background and started up Lean Six Sigma within the distribution operation and leaned that out over a couple of years. And then my career grew at Cintas quite well. Ended up, you know, taking on the entire global supply chain plus all the fleet management. And again, I thought I'd retire at Cintas because it was just fantastic opportunities. We grew that company from when I started 1 billion in sales, by the time I left 6 billion in sales. So great growth rate. And then a company called New Balance came calling and said, hey, we have an opportunity to kind of lead the supply chain in the COO type role. And would you come out and talk to us? And I said, I love New Balance, the brand. And I'm still thinking about retiring at Cintas over the next, you know, 15, 20 years, but I would love to talk to you about it. And I came out and talked to New Balance, talked to the owners, Jim and Ann Davis, and just to hear their vision of the company, and probably equally as important, the culture and how they run the company as a family-oriented organization, their values, the culture in general, just really resonated with me. And I made what I think is the final leap into the fourth leg of my career. So all different reasons. And each one, like I say, I thought maybe I would retire at each one of those. It's interesting how things evolve, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Love it. Now, New Balance, you've done a lot of things since you joined about 6 years ago. You know, I think, again, there's a story about incredible revenue growth. And you mentioned that there was a public announcement because New Balance is a private company, but there's a public announcement that last year you grew 23% revenue, which is quite incredible given that also conditions changed quite a bit, right, from COVID to post-COVID, which was 2023. I want to ask you some examples, and we discussed a little bit offline, some case studies of what your most impactful projects have been in the end-to-end global operations of New Balance. And I think you spoke specifically about the fact that perhaps the systems and the backbone, of course, has been there for a while. There were a lot of efficiencies, analytics, and so on that you could put on top. So tell us a little bit about that aspect, Dave, and let's go into a practical case study where our audience can learn a lot from.
Oh, sure thing. Yeah, it's a great question as well. Yeah, so I joined back in 2017, and as I walked in the door, you know, it's the usual, let me take 90 days and assess the situation, and I'll come up with a game plan. And at the top of my list was really focused on system capability, because there are 20, 30-year-old systems, legacy systems. And I think, you know, most companies struggle with that as well. I have not talked to any of my peers that say they love the system that they have. It's perfect. And that's just kind of the nature of the system. So, but we currently still have systems that don't really even know that the internet exists, to be honest. I mean, 20 to 30 years old and still running a company at $6.5 billion. In the way that, so when I came in and assessed it, I kind of charted out two paths. One is, let's get a new ERP and supply chain planning suite underway. We need a complete replacement for it. That's certainly not an overnight thing when you're a global company and we have six different regions around the world. You know, we'll start this new ERP in North America, but then it needs to go to EMEA and then to China and then to APAC. So I knew it would be at least a 4 to 5 year project. So, but we started down that path and that's well underway. I'll mention where we are on that in a second. The second path really was focused on how do we leverage the systems that we have in place now? Because they're not going anywhere. It's still running the company. And this, again, is back in 2017. And so we plotted out a path to create data lakes and ways that we could drill into that data and help run the business in a much more efficient and effective way. And so I'll mention maybe two things. One is master data. We'll call it data quality. I think many companies struggle with that as well. We put in a master data type organization to create governance, to create data stewards for each data type so that we could really have one version of the truth. We had, to be honest, we had meetings where, you know, people would come in with different answers to the same question because they're looking at different data sources, and really hard to make good business decisions when you have that, you know, issue underway. And so, you know, how do we get our data so that we have one version of the truth? And then, as I mentioned, we created a centralized database that basically scraped from all these various systems. And that could be SQL, that may have been, you know, just Excel databases, all these different legacy systems, pulling it all together in one Snowflake database. And then we engaged in a couple of programs. I would say probably most prominent, Spotfire. It's a visualization tool and also a drill down capability teamed up with Power BI. Those two really brought us incredible insights based on various business needs, you know, like what is the bias on each individual style that we're out there planning for? How good are we at forecasting? Where can we get better? What kind of data sources could we inject into the demand forecasting process to become more accurate? And so it really helped us become so much better in the supply chain planning world, which in my mind is the nucleus. The better we are within supply chain planning, meaning demand and supply planning, the better the entire end-to-end operation works. And so we really focused there first. Then we have brought in other tools like Python and JavaScript and HTML to really begin more advanced data analytics. And so creating that one small but mighty team called Advanced Analytics, my mind was like really game changing, because it created that layer over all these disconnected, disparate systems to give us really good business insights to be able to make better decisions. So that was a game changer for us. I think certainly I wouldn't want to dismiss the effort that we did within the HR organizational, you know, the people side of things. Because I think I'm a big believer that people are the most important part of any organization. And so investing in the team, reorganizing, making sure all the org charts make sense. We went through about a year of that. And so aligning an overall global planning team with real strategic sourcing that has, you know, multiple steps of discipline to make sure that we get the best possible sources lined up, that, you know, it's good for both parties. So good strategic sourcing. We make our own product in our own factories, you know, that entire organizational chart for reporting. We have our own innovation team. We have all the distribution. So the people side of things, getting that all lined up, and then just really investing in our people to make them the best possible leaders that they possibly can be. I think all of that coming together, not only the data and you know, empowering people to make better decisions, but the people themselves was an important step. Those two together really helped us basically double the business over the just short period of time that I've been at New Balance.
And I believe that this is a common problem. I mean, I speak to executives, to CEOs, to board members, to CEOs, CSCOs, and this quite a few companies have this situation where they have different sources of truth. They have, literally, I was speaking to one the other day, and they had hundreds. It's you know, in the 20, 30 billion revenue, and they've done many acquisitions over time, hundreds of versions of the same, well, ERPs. So even, I mean, with all the new layer that you put on top, the reality is that you end up, you know, with even if it's the technology is super smart, because the data quality is not there, and you're looking at you're getting different answers from different people, you just end up making bad decisions faster. And
That's
I
for
want to
sure.
go one level deeper in your sharing, because I think there's usually some key principles which make the Pareto principle, right? 20% that gets 80% of the results. So you mentioned, big picture, right? It was a lot to do with setting in the right tech processes, and then org chart and people. Even deeper than that, are there certain, even more specific than that, I guess, Dave, are there, say, okay, look, this particular thing made most of the, well, I mean, it's never most of the impact, because it's always a lot of different things, right? But you know what I mean. There's usually certain aspects that that have a disproportionate amount of impact as compared to perhaps others.
Yeah, good question. I guess maybe I'll mention two because they're kind of tied for first. I think on the people side of things, I kind of came in pretty strong with my, I'll call it school of hard knocks characteristics that I expect in every single individual, what we call associates, each employee. And so really sharing those, I have 10 key characteristics of a leader, and making sure everybody's on the same page as they walk in the door so that they bring the best version of themselves that I need on the team. And we have one team that's all working together. I think as a leader, it's really important to set the tone and not require everybody to imagine what's expected, but to actually say, look, I need these 10 things out of you. And if they can't get there, well, then let's talk about that. But at least they know what's expected. And I think just being super clear about that as far as characteristics of each individual. And, like the first one is you've got to be coachable and check your ego at the door. Everybody has an ego. Some people have really big egos. And within my organization, that doesn't work real well. And we all need to be humble and realize that we don't know all the answers. And that really, I think, creates a positive work environment. So, again, really simple 10 key characteristics. But unless the leader at the top says what they are, everyone imagines what they are. And that tends to be different across the board. So, I think that leadership component is super important. And I think maybe just one level down, specifically to your question, I think it really is in that demand planning, supply planning capability. And so I mentioned the reporting that we created, which is, indicates bias. I think it's the system that does rough cut capacity planning. So our supply planning team can be very specific around how much capacity can we offer up and how much do we need to negotiate with our third party suppliers, or how much more capacity do we need to build within our own infrastructure of manufacturing that we own. It's the solver capability, which is a whole other program that we created internally that then loads the factories in the most efficient way so that we can get not only the most capacity, but also be able to drive down costs and level out the peaks and valleys that occur on a natural basis. So it's really been super specific within the production planning team, seemed to really help us navigate through all those massive peaks and valleys that happened through the COVID years of essentially 2020, 21, 22. And we came out of that COVID phase stronger, far stronger than we were going in 2019.
And it might be that part of the, just thinking out on the loud and on the spot for a second, it probably is also the fact that you have, end-to-end operation, product development under you. You have all this big range of functions that report into one strategic COO role. Not all companies are necessarily organized like that. I'm actually curious, was New Balance always, I mean, I'm pretty sure it wasn't, right? when was the moment that the COO role, right, had all these different pieces together? So specifically, product development sometimes does not sit under, under the COO, and that can be a big challenge for a lot of organizations. Or there's others, I mean, a different industry though, but you know, they have manufacturing on one, they have planning and logistics on another one, and then you have procurement, it's a separate. So there's like three different, which obviously contributes to silo mentality, and if you don't have that end to end, it leads to a lot of different challenges. So to me, the structure that you have in place and what you have as your team in New Balance is a great structure, and it helps influence and push through faster and better decisions. But I'm just curious, when was it taken within New Balance that this is a structure that makes sense, and what led to that? I mean, I don't know if it was before your time or if it was with you coming in on as CEO.
Yeah, I think, you know, the benefit of it, first off, is that I can only blame myself, to your point. Everything is my fault, or everything is successful because of my organization. But yeah, seriously, you're 100% right on, because everything's integrated, which is perfect. Within that, like I say, that first 90 days, as I evaluated the organization and the pros and cons and, you know, where are the gaps? One of the gaps was that kind of a disconnect between the sourcing organization and the development team. Because quite often, like you say, if they don't report under the same umbrella or organization, they look at each other, you know, pointing fingers, essentially. Development takes their tech packs and could potentially throw it over the fence into sourcing or manufacturing, and they're left to deal with it. And then when there are issues, nobody knows who caused it. And so as I came in the door, I said, look, really to make this effective, development needs to be under my organization, and then I'll fully own it. You know, whether it works or not, at least I own it and it's fully integrated. And so that happened in the first year that I was at New Balance. And I think it made a huge difference, because now it's essentially seamless from the time the creation team, the design team, which, you know, that's a whole different side of your brain. That design team is phenomenal. And they're a global organization coming up with just really creative designs. Once they're done and that brief is put together, my development team then takes it and makes it a reality that can be manufactured effectively and with the right quality level that we're looking for. So I just love the pickup right at development all the way through to the final delivery. It really works out well.
Yeah, let me play devil advocate, because I can already hear people listening to this podcast and saying, yeah, all right, Dave, but you're shrewd negotiator, you came in there and negotiated this very fast. Not the same in my organization. You don't understand my organization, Dave. It's you know, we are set up like, I tell you specifically, it's an industrial group, right? And then you have planning, logistics on one side, you have procurement on one side, you have manufacturing on the third area of responsibility, and all three eventually roll up to, now I forget, but one of the executive board members. So anyway, if you were one of these three, right, in this type of an organization, how, because there's got to be a way, right? And I want to answer to these people that are already in a structure that perhaps, you know, is already set in that way. What would you do to pull off okay, let's just come together and agree and influence the board that, look, end-to-end actually makes most sense?
Yeah, it's certainly not an easy task, right? Yeah. Because it can be viewed as territorial, stepping on toes, all the other challenges in a corporate environment. But as an engineer, I'm always data-driven and looking for continuous improvement opportunities. I mean, my approach would be, I mean, I can give you a real world example. We did the exact same thing at Cintas. When I joined, as I mentioned, all those functions reported up to different parts of the organization, whether it was, you know, sourcing, production planning, there was a little bit of manufacturing, distribution, all different parts. And it only rolled up, it finally all rolled up to the CEO in various ways. And as we got in and tried to fix first distribution, we realized part of it was a distribution issue, but part of it was an upstream input into distribution. And we analyzed, what is that issue? how could we make it better? And so then we came up with a connection up into production planning. We made changes there kind of collectively and collaboratively with that leader, because it wasn't under our umbrella. We made that positive change. And then we began to identify other changes that we could make. And it was kind of all with the view of an integrated supply chain. We took that vision then, and we pitched that to the CEO and said, hey, you know, we could continue down this path right now with all these organizations reporting differently, or we can make it look like this. And it would then solve these issues this way, you know, with a nice, it was like a short deck, 5 slides, where we said, do it this way as we are, or integrate everyone together without any names in any boxes. You know, it's not a self-serving push, but gosh, we could be so much better if we went down this path. And he said yes. And so we headed down that path. So I think it's using examples, using facts of where the problems are, and how that new design could really help solve a lot of those issues. And so that's an actual real world example of how we did that at Cintas. And like I say, we grew from 1 billion to 6 billion in the time that I was there. So I would say that part of it certainly enabled the organization to grow.
Love it. And I hope this provides a no excuse, go and make it happen. Answer this for some. This for some, I'm sure. Final question from me, Dave. So there's a lot of people that are young, starting their careers, listening to this. What would be some advice that you would share to them that made the most difference for you to make it to the executive board, to a C-level position?
Yeah, gosh, that could be a full day conversation, actually. I'll try to, maybe just a couple of thoughts would be, for me anyways, I always think about the role that I'm in as a T, you know, so the T across the top is being broad, being aware, and being curious across all parts of the company, not being just siloed into your role. And kind of the vertical part of the T is really about the role that you're in, being the best possible version of yourself, the real craft of that job, being as deep as you possibly can. So like, I'm going to be the best head of logistics I possibly can. Or if I'm a production planner and I'm doing forecasting, I'm going to figure out how I can get into as much education. I'm going to network across different companies. I'm going to learn from them. I'm going to talk to different systems providers. Maybe there are different tools out there, and I'm going to offer those up to my direct supervisor. I'm going to just be as great as I possibly can. So that's kind of that vertical piece. In the meantime, like, how does my role connect upstream and downstream so that I can be as good of a provider as I possibly can, you know, downstream? And then how can I affect upstream into the supply inputs that are coming to me so that I can do my job as well as possible? So I always think about it in that T perspective. That would be one, just be great at your job and be broad. And I think it often gets overlooked, but I'll just mention it again. I think that ego part of it, you know, some people come into the job and I want to be VP tomorrow. That part of it gets in the way, and it doesn't become, you know, you're not a good team player. Your other teammates are, you know, going to become, you know, disconnected. What you want to do is come in and be, you know, a real person every single day and just do an awesome job. Raise up all the good things that you're doing in a kind of a nice, delicate, positive way, without having a big ego sort, you know, associated with it. So check your ego at the door, and then make sure you understand, you know, where the company's headed, and just do all kinds of support to help the company get there. So those are just a few. Like I say, I have 10 others. I have 10 total, and would be glad to share that at any point in time as well.
Actually, I would be really curious to see the 10 principles of leadership at New Balance. As you know, there was this, and now I forget how many there were. I think there were 22 or at Amazon. And very similar to what you said, I spoke to the former chief of staff of Jeff Bezos, Colin Breyer, and Colin was there when Amazon was started. I mean, he was there, he joined as the 50th employee. And when I asked him this, you know, 20% at least 80%, or one of the most impactful things that they did in Amazon, he also, interestingly enough, to your point, he referred to when we set up the principles of Amazon, it made a huge difference because we had distilled basically the elements of our culture so that people can no longer guess what it is, just as what you said, right? Interestingly enough. And we knew, okay, these are the 10 principles at New Balance, right? This is what, you know, a good leader looks like, and it's clear for everybody. They should be on the same page. Secondly, I loved your tea analogy. I mean, what a great one. Be the best that you can at your job, and at the same time, keep your interests broad so that you engage upstream and downstream. Loved it. Loved it. So, Dave, been a pleasure, absolute privilege to share with you and today, and thanks for all the great examples. And yeah, let's go, Sorana Cristea, Romanian.
Yeah, pleasure to join, and yeah, hopefully a couple of helpful insights, and for everybody in the supply chain, let's go. Lots to do.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.